not long ago, high on a mountain in Idaho. In Idaho, I was living free. So I sold off shotgun to a deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down. My good dog killed my boy, my only son, my pride and joy. They shot my wife dead on the floor, holding our baby in the cabin door.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please don't shoot me down.
And you want to go build a cabin in Idaho, in Idaho. If you're living free, boys, don't sell no shotgun, no deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down.
Well, good evening. This is Truth Quest, and it's KHENLP 106.9 Salida. It's 38 degrees out there, and I've got a co-host. Oh, that was... I'm going to get a hard time from my co-host again because that was his song, Ruby Ridge, on his Bluegrass Conspiracy album. And my co-host, of course, is Eric Carlstrom. And tonight we've got a special guest, Alfred Weber. And before I get into that first, though, I'll go ahead and say the opinions expressed by the host and guests on this show do not necessarily represent the views of KHEN, its staff, or board of directors. And while I'm at it, are you there, Alfred?
I am here, and I'm very happy to join you. I'm a great supporter of...
Okay, well, let me go ahead.
Video and I think that you have a great thing going there.
Oh, well, thank you. Let me go ahead and introduce Alfred, and it sounds like I'm going to have some maybe an issue with my earphones here. I hope everybody's hearing me fine. Alfred is a member of the District of Columbia Bar. He's a former Fulbright scholar and graduate of Yale University, Yale University and Yale Law School, and the University of Texas Counseling Program. Alfred was general counselor for the New York City Environmental Protection Agency and environmental consultant for the Ford Foundation, futurist at Stanford Research Institute, and author. He has taught economics at Yale University and civil liberties at the University of Texas Government Department. Weber has been a delegate to the Unispace Outer Space Conference and NGO representative at the United Nations for the Communications Coordination Community for the UN, UN Second Special Session on Disarmament, elected Clinton Gore delegate to the 1996 Texas Department Democratic Convention, and a member of the Governor's Emergency Task Force on Earthquake Preparedness, State of California in 1980-82, and appointed by Governor Jerry Brown, Alfred has produced and hosted The instant of cooperation, the first live radio broadcast between USA and the then Soviet Union, carried live by Gustela Radio and NPR Satellite in 1987. He is an on-air host on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. Alfred, are you there again now?
I'm right here.
Oh, okay. So I'm having a little bit of issue on my headphone, and I'm not sure what that is about, but we'll work through it. Are you there, Eric?
Yes, and you're coming in loud and clear, Melody. Now let's see if we can hear Alfred.
Hey.
Alfred, we can hear you. Excellent. Okay, ready to go here.
Okay. First of all, I guess, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into so many different things that are varied, and particularly into the, how about in the radio business here?
yes. Well, you know, my passion is to communicate, and my other passion is to see that justice is done, that fundamental justice is done. And I guess those are two of the principles that have driven my life. So they've come together in public interest radio, and they've come together in a fairly sustained study of what I finally come to call the International War Crimes Racketeering Organization. Which is a legal framework by which we can finally begin to assign legal accountability to the principal owners and promoters of the permanent war economy. And that's the economic system under which humankind generally finds itself now. That's something that I've done for the past 30 years of endeavor, and it was the assassination of John F. Kennedy that first got me started in this area, and it was through examining that false flag operation and all of its ramifications, which again 30 years later repeated itself in the false flag operation of 9/11 by many of the same principal actors. I found myself growing up around these people. Richard B. Cheney, now Vice President of the United States, flunked out of Yale. His sophomore year, he was a year ahead of me on the Yale campus. George W. Bush was on the campus while I was at Yale Law School. And both of these men are, in my judgment, lifelong losers and sociopaths, and fulfill all of the definitions of the people who were attracted to the Third Reich and now have attempted to bring down the American Republic have not yet succeeded. So I've been tracking these individuals for a long time, and those are two of the motors that involve me in community radio, in listener-sponsored radio, and in communicating to a public where the public gets the facts and the truth that are often denied to them by the mainstream media, so that we can begin to take action at the grassroots level.
Alfred, I actually had a chance to hear. This is Eric here.
Eric.
Hi, Alfred. I got a chance to hear you in a couple of talks, lectures on that you gave during one of the 911 conferences in Vancouver, and
oh, yeah.
You put together a very, very compelling set of facts. And I've been very interested in 911 as well ever since it occurred. I think many of us knew pretty much from the get-go that something was very wrong with that particular incident, that something was very fishy. I was just going to ask you, your first when and how did you first get interested in the 911 issue? I guess your JFK research prepared you for seeing through the scam immediately. Would that be true?
You know, that's a very good question. I suppose it's like the John F. Kennedy issue that everybody who was alive, or at least, you know, back in our generation, could remember. Where were you when you heard the news that John F. Kennedy had been shot? And it's one of those archetypal moments that we can all remember. And I remember exactly where I was when I heard that news. Likewise, my theory is that many people in the present generation have taken as an archetypal moment, which is part of the false flag operation design, where they first heard the news about 9/11, about the World Trade Center towers. And I was 2 days before that, on September 9, 2001, we had a conference that we had sponsored, the Institute for Cooperation in Space, which is the nonprofit organization that I'm international director of, had sponsored a conference at Simon Fraser University here. And I actually had an appointment to meet with the former Foreign Minister of Canada, Lloyd Axworthy, who was then with the Liu Center University of British Columbia, on the morning of 9/11 to talk about, along with my co-director, Dr. Carol Rosin, who had come up for the conference, to talk about preventing the weaponization of space. Well, Carol called me on the phone and said, turn on the television. I turned on the television, and there was, you know, flames coming out or smoke coming out of one of the Twin Towers. So that was the moment, and instinctually I knew that it was a false flag, because something like that just doesn't happen, you know. Later on, very soon after that, I think it was within minutes or within 30 minutes, I had we then had a thing called Echo News Service, and through one of our correspondents, we got an email describing of a cell phone call from a U.S. sailor in a U.S. Navy carrier off of the east coast of the U.S. And in that cell phone call to some of his relatives, I think it was, he described that the government was involved in this attack. And we published that email on Echo News. In fact, it was our first entry on what later became our 9/11 strategic deception desk. And because we called it a strategic deception operation. So I think that officially we were probably one of the first news agencies in the world that posted news from a U.S. military or any other source that 9/11 was a false flag operation.
You did that within a day or two?
It was very, very, yeah, within either that same day or the day after. I actually went back and found that original email and forwarded it to somebody within the last month, just to show them how early we were on that particular case.
What did they base that on?
I'm sorry?
What did they base it on for making that kind of assumption?
This was a U.S. sailor calling from a carrier, saying that the U.S. government was part of the operation. And it came through one of our correspondents, and we deemed it newsworthy, and we ran it.
evidently this individual had been involved in some part of the operation. Is that correct? Or knew about the operation through some agency, news agency or something? I mean, did this individual have first-hand experience?
So what's the relevance of that? Well, if you look at some of the analysis of the false flag operation, both on the World Trade Center towers and on the Pentagon, there's a lot of evidence to show that aircraft from a U.S. naval carrier carrying cruise missiles were used against the Pentagon and against the World Trade Center. So the false flag operation, operationally, I mean, if we're going to get into operational issues about the 9/11 false flag operation, it was a U.S. carrier off the East Coast. I think it was off the East Coast of New Jersey, where a specific types of aircraft took off, loaded with cruise missiles that were deployed against the Pentagon. One became the, quote, airliner that went into the Pentagon. That was, in fact, a cruise missile. And there's photographs. There's the depleted uranium readings from the depleted uranium warhead of the cruise missile, which were confirmed by the EPA two or three days later. That is the levels of depleted uranium. The fact that it is a complete, a series of holes going through, and at the end, the people inside the Pentagon had marked punch out hole, which is a military term used when there's a kinetic energy penetrator, which is what a cruise missile is. So there was no aircraft involved at all. There was no aircraft that hit the Pentagon. It was a cruise missile, and it probably came from a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier off of the East Coast. So that's the evidentiary relevance there.
Yeah, you know, I've read accounts of aircraft carriers in the harbor off of New York City as well, but I'm a little fuzzy in my memory as to exactly how that fit in. So it's interesting to hear the more complete story there.
Such a sailor on the aircraft carrier would have been part of the crew that launched that attack.
So this would be a whistleblower, then right away. Okay, so this is an interesting question.
You know, maybe not a whistleblower kind of a below the radar whistleblower.
Yeah, it's fascinating to be able to talk to you about the operational side of the 911 operation. We've had Jim Fetzer on this program before, and
Jim is a great gentleman. He is so tremendous. He's a prodigious scholar, and he's very courageous. And I feel privileged to have attended and having spoke at his Madison 9/11 Scholars Conference this past August. And I just got an email from Jim yesterday, whereby he's putting together a book by the speakers at that conference, so we'll all be preparing a chapter each for it.
I'm certainly looking forward to that. And since we're on this topic, Alfred, and since you're on top of it, because you've been to these very, very recent conferences that have had the most, I would say, the pick of the best of the researchers, could you briefly, somehow, I know it's a complex operation, could you briefly tell us what you think happened on 9/11?
There's that saying, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. There's no area like the 9/11 area, I think, where that saying applies. And I say, hey, listen, I'll plunge ahead and I'll make a fool of myself, but at least I'll say what I believe the case to be based on the evidence. And I had a very, one of those awakenings. It's like stepping into a cold shower on a cold winter morn, and that was when I returned from the Madison 9/11 conference, and I went on a number of nationwide radio talk shows in the U.S. Speaking about what I called the new 9/11 paradigm, and I found myself, and this is a commentary on the 9/11 culture itself. I found myself suddenly, whereas a month before I had been, respectfully listened to by these large audiences, and as soon as I said, well, this is what I believe on the best evidence occurred, I was subjected to obscene and harassing emails, obscene and harassing phone calls, what I call gang stalking and quasi-fascistic behavior by major 9/11 truth organizations, and I use the word truth organizations as opposed to scholars for 9/11 truth. So that taught me a great deal about the mechanism of the cover-up and how in these false flag operations, numerous false leads are implanted, and also there are very deep operatives of the permanent war economy who either consciously or unconsciously perpetrate partial cover stories that keep the 9/11 cover-up in place. You will notice that this issue, I think, has about at least 50, if not more, percent of the U.S. public opinion believe there should be a new investigation. And in my working with the U.S. Congress, including with John Conyers, the head of the Judiciary Committee, whom we presented the 9/11 Independent Prosecutors Act to, there is zero movement. The cover-up is firmly in place. Well, having said that, and having found myself being hit with brickabats, and every sort of insult, fortunately I was, took it as a research opportunity to look at yet another layer of the cover-up, but it was personally very painful. My best estimate, and again, I don't approach this as an expert researcher. My role was to facilitate, or is to facilitate, the 9/11 Independent Prosecutor Act and the 9/11 War Crimes Tribunal, because I believe that the acts involved there rise to the level of war crimes under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court and under the various conventions governing war crimes. So that's kind of my preamble, but I'm very grateful for you asking the question. And I will answer it, and it may be that we'll both be in profound disagreement with each other, but this is the conclusion that I've come to, and it's after listening and studying very closely all of the presenters at the 9/11 Scholars Conference, after being on radio programs with them, with the work of Dr. Judy Wood, the work of Andrew Johnson, who's a British researcher, other works having to do with the presence of planes or not. What I believe occurred at the World Trade Center, first of all, in the 9/11 false flag operation, was an extremely advanced form of warfare, and that this was carried out by a sort of the black budget branch of the U.S. military intelligence to kind of show off its latest toys. And my background is in saying this is that we at the Institute for Cooperation in Space, we've been in business now since the early 1980s. Our job is to prevent the weaponization of space. So we're very familiar with the issue of space-based weapons, of directed energy weapons, scalar weapons, the issue of HARP, all of these advance, the issue of fourth-generation nuclear weapons, and the integration of high-level military intelligence command and control systems, which now dictate, as a matter of military policy, that military operations can be programmed like a movie or like a cartoon. That is, there's a large psychological component to them, and you want the targeted population, in the case of 9/11, it was the United States and the world, to view this manufactured reality because it's a strategic deception operation, and there's a specific branch of warfare that does that. Okay, having said all of that, in my humble opinion, what happened at the World Trade Center towers was that 80% of the mass of the World Trade Center towers were transformed into nanoparticles within a matter of seconds through the use of very advanced directed energy weapons. We'll just put that up as a black box. It could be have been HARP. It could have been a land-based, air-based, or space-based directed energy weapon. And perhaps combined with the use of a fourth-generation nuclear weapon down at the bottom of the towers, but that the directed energy weapon, which transforms the mass into nanoparticles within a matter of seconds, accounts for all of the evidence, and that is there was practically no rubble, no debris. If you go through and you follow all of the patterns falling, if you go to, as Dr. Judy Wood, who was a brilliant mechanical engineering professor at Clemson before she lost her job because of her research in this issue. But I think if you go to, it's either drjudywood.org or drjudywood.com, you will see a tour de force into all of this, and you will see the telltale marks of a directed energy weapon attack or a HARP attack involved in various the disintegration of metal versus paper is just not affected at all. The fact that there are no artifacts, the fact that there are no bodies, the largest body part was ever found was a portion of one finger, and all of it is the signature of a advanced directed energy weapon. Secondly, through the use of other experts, no planes were used at all, in my humble opinion, on September 11, 2001. No planes were used at the World Trade Center site, at the Pentagon site, and in Pennsylvania, no planes were used. And none of those involved a plane crash. It's probably cruise missiles used at all sites. With regard to the psychological effect that most people saw or believe that they saw planes hitting the Twin Towers, that has been expertly demonstrated in recent films such as September Clues, which show that all of the film footage showing planes hitting the Twin Towers are in fact edited pixels that were broadcast by certain news agencies and form a core integral part of the false flag operation. That is, that you have a situation where the World Trade Center towers were taken out by an advanced directed energy weapon that just poofed, turned the World Trade Center towers into nanoparticles, and through well-placed NSA and CIA operatives in the major media, such as has been established since the 1950s through Operation Mockingbird, films that were edited showing planes coming in were actually shown to the viewing public, and that's what they believe happened because of that. That the DVDs of the Madison 9/11 conference will be released in the next couple of weeks. And I believe that they are transformatory, and they bring about a new 9/11 paradigm. And what I've lived over the last 60 days or so, I was just invited on a 3-week speaking tour on 9/11 of Australia a month ago, only to have it 2 weeks ago canceled. And that what will happen at the end of this process will be an uncovering of the cover-up and showing how this was a massive operation of the most advanced parts of the black budget military intelligence establishment of the U.S. and of what I call the echelon countries, the U.K., Canada, the U.S., Australia, etc.
Just to let you know where I'm coming from on this, Alfred, I agree with you.
Oh, great. Oh, my Lord, I can't believe it. I thought I was going to be beaten over the head with wet noodles again.
to tell you where I'm coming from, I was on to this issue pretty quickly, and I wrote a paper within a year. And then I kept following it, and in 2006 I wrote another paper which got longer and longer until it was 75 pages, and I was a fool who rushed in to try to really put it together. But when I did put it together, I didn't have the pieces of the puzzle that came out at about the time when I finished the paper, which September 11, 2006, which was Judy Wood's hypothesis about the directed energy weapons, and what came out slightly later was the whole faked video no planes theory. And somebody was going to publish my book, and I said, no, wait a minute, I have to go check out these two new ideas. So I went to the Chandler conference, and there I heard Jim Fetzer talk about Judy Wood's site, and then I started really checking into it. And I think Judy Wood's site is a tour de force, and I think the Ace Baker and September Clues and 911 Octopus 911 videos really pretty well prove that the videos were faked, the ones that everyone believes showed them that the planes went into the building. So what I've come up with is very close to what you're coming up with. And so now I'll ask you a personal question. Do you think it's worth my while to publish my book, or do you think I just might as well save myself a headache and let you guys do all the front work?
I think that it's so vital that this new perspective get through. And I directly witnessed what Dr. Judy Wood has been through. I mean, her assistant was murdered because she was working on this stuff. That I think that the more voices that publish what the true paradigm of 9/11 is, the better. Because this is the cover-up of the cover-up that we're busting through. Right. And a friend of mine, a colleague of mine, Andrew Johnson, I mean, you know, not to get personal about it, but just came out with a very long article exposing the connections to the Department of Energy of some of the current popes of 9/11 that have been writing in the area and that will be the principal figures in the Australia tour that I, you know, was bumped off of because of my views. And you can see how that person is functionally covering for these advanced weapons which were developed by the Department of Energy. So it really is wheels within wheels within wheels, but I would encourage you to really publish that book. I think that we need to get out there what the true magnitude of this event was.
Yeah, I appreciate that, but I do suggest that this was a bit of a mixed message you gave me when you told me about Judy Wood's assistant being killed.
But that was trying to prevent her from getting out her message.
Right, right.
She now has her message out, so functionally there is no reason for that to go forward.
So I glean then that you pretty much have the same 9-1-1 research heroes that I do, which include people like Judy Wood and Jim Fetzer and the Ace Baker video fakery stuff. Are there others that Webster Tarpley, are you a big fan of his in terms of putting together
the
story?
Yeah, I participated in a couple of those. There were Sunday night conference calls with Webster. He and I have spoken at a couple of the same conferences, so I got to know him better, and we've exchanged emails and strategy. And when he came out with the Kennebunkport warning, I thought that was a real strategic moment and a strategic act, because I think that at that moment we were in great peril, especially since it was the time that the cruise missiles from those B-52s, where there was one cruise missile, is still missing, I think. And there has been responsible analysis by Webster, by Dr. Michael Sala, and by others who demonstrate that missile could have had several different destinations, one of which is that it may have been the basis for a second false flag operation on U.S. soil. And I think that as a nation, and I speak now from, I'm a dual citizen of the U.S. and of Canada, so if I could speak on in my U.S. side, my U.S. hat right now, I think that as a nation we went through a grave moment. And what I did at that moment is where I have been writing, and that is as a civil liberties lawyer, as a constitutional lawyer, I wrote articles and gave talks on the issues of the martial law matrix, a legal matrix of martial law, which has been set up in the U.S. through various, you know, National Security Presidential Directive 51, which in the event of a catastrophic emergency essentially dissolves the Constitution and places all power in the executive, the authority over the legislative branch and the executive branch and the judicial branch in the U.S. president. And that's one example of legal measures that are part of a matrix to bring martial law. The definition of martial law is military government to the U.S. for the purpose of enslavement of the population and bringing the U.S. population down to second-class citizenship and destroying the U.S. and all the major democracies in the service of an international criminal war crimes elite, which do not believe in democratic principles.
Before we get into this issue, which is a gigantic one and I think is the next logical topic, could you just comment on a comment that we got from, I think, someone you know, Loren Murray, who we had on the show.
And, oh, good.
She mentioned, and I think she was with you in Vancouver and also with you in this International War Crimes Tribunal in Kuala Lumpur.
Yes.
She mentioned, based on her experience, that she thinks much of the 911 truth movement is, in fact, a counterintelligence operation. And I guess now you'd be in a position to comment on maybe... can you give your interpretation
of
that?
Yes. Yes. That's my research finding from the personal experience that I went through when I went public with the Judy Wood model, with the directed energy model in mid-August, and what I experienced was that the technology of COINTELPRO, whereby organizations in a particular progressive or cause or movement area are infiltrated not only by operatives but by a specific consciousness technology, such that they acquire kind of a quasi-fascistic outlook on their own. They will adopt a strict Stephen Jones point of view, for example. And if anyone deviates from that, there's the individuals within it, I believe, at a subconscious level, using known mind control techniques developed as part of the COINTELPRO program, actually become like kind of brown shirt groups. They become quasi-fascistic in nature, and their job is to attack and eliminate any research that goes contrary to the established opposition, research, such that in the minds of the false flag operation designers, they built in a controlled opposition. And the controlled opposition in the 9/11 movement is, it was chemical detonations, either C4 or some other level of military detonations that brought down the towers. That's the controlled opposition, because what you're trying to keep secret is the really advanced directed energy weapons, which then, if that were exposed, not only would their black budget secrets be exposed, but the extent of the government involvement in 9/11, which was total. It was total. Entire operations. You know, that was a war games scenario of the largest sort.
Okay. You talk about the controlled opposition movement being built into the operation, which is fascinating and does seem to fit the facts with the Stephen Jones contingent that is providing that story. For those of the listeners who aren't familiar with Dr. Stephen Jones, he came out with he's a physics professor from Brigham Young University, who came out in 2005 with what would then everybody thought was a pretty radical stance, which was that, yes, it was controlled demolition that brought down the World Trade Centers, but it was done with cutter charges, explosives that broke the steel beams, etc. And but then there was a rift between Steve Jones and Judy Woods and Jim Fetzer, and now after about a year and a half, the dust is starting to settle, I think, and it seems pretty obvious, at least to me, and obviously to you, that Steve Jones is fulfilling this controlled opposition.
Yes, and it has and it continues to have harmful effects. For example, he is now going to lead a three-week tour of Australia next spring. So the entire Australian public, which now just a few days ago voted out John Howard as prime minister, the Bush regime kind of puppet fell there, but now they're what is coming in is a traveling roadshow that is yet another level of controlled opposition, and which is masking the true facts, so that my sincere belief is that the reason why, the fundamental reason why the 9/11 movement has not achieved significant legislative impact in the way that the impeachment movement has, which now has an active bill at the Judiciary Committee level, is that the movement is presenting false facts, and they're presenting a controlled opposition or a subtle disinformation view. And the American public and the legal process at some level knows this. there would be no way that a new investigation could go forward and find anything so long as the controlled opposition becomes the testimony that is presented at the new investigation. And this is going on in Canada as well, because I just noticed that the 9/11 Truth Movement in Victoria just drafted a long four-page letter to the Parliament demanding hearings here, and it's widely publicized, and you're supposed to sign it, and it's four pages. They start with saying, world-known expert Stephen Jones, and then they just quote Stephen Jones for four pages, and they're running around getting signatures to send into the Canadian Parliament. Well, how can you have a legal process proceed on a false version of the truth? It's a surefire way to keep your issue from being heard. As a legal matter.
What about John McCarthy and that grand jury that they tried to put together? Was it in San Diego? Or were you familiar with that?
Yeah, I've been in. I think that those are all excellent, starts. I'm trying to develop my own strategic posture toward the 9/11 movement now, since I have discovered all of these various levels and tried to express it in a way that doesn't increase polarization within the movement, that is, gives more light than smoke. And I think that that's a real task at this point. So personally, what I'm going to do over the next month or so is concentrate on writing my chapter for Professor Fetzer's book. And then seeing what happens after that, and I'm a little less optimistic now than I was when I started this out as to the fate of the 9/11 War Crimes Tribunal. Quite frankly, what I did over the last 60 days was I put all of my shoulder to the wheel of the anti-impeachment movement and worked behind the scenes with the Kucinich campaign to get what was a very unexpected legislative victory for his impeachment resolution. Now, in the 9/11 Independent Prosecutor Act, which is under Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution, not under Article 2, which is the impeachment article, you can take 9/11 as an additional grounds for impeachment. Kucinich hasn't wanted to do that because there are such clear grounds for impeachment under the weapons of mass destruction ground in Iraq, and under some of the associated issues, trying to cut down civil liberties here in the States.
If I could get back, Alfred, to something you said earlier when you were talking about how these 911 truth movements get infiltrated by operatives and by kind of a consciousness mentality. You talked about how the kind of the brown shirt types are victim of mind control techniques or are using mind control techniques. I was a little fuzzy on the mind control techniques.
You know, there's a great paradox to this. I don't think that there's great infiltration. I think that that's an old model from the 40s and the 50s, from the 30s, 40s, and 50s. I think that there's a much newer model now of co-option, of opposition movements. And this is through the use of mind control techniques and specific technologies such as Co-IntelPro, which is where you can have, what you're doing is that you're propagating memes, which are very, very powerful thought forms, and technologies such as gang stalking, which are mind control, electronic harassment technologies that have been developed in the 60s and 70s are now being applied on university campuses and at workplaces, and you can apply these within movements, such as there is no infiltrator in the classic sense of a paid agent, but rather there's a matrix of behavior and thought which takes over, and that is reinforced through technologies like gang stalking. That is reinforced through electronic mind control harassment, which is carried out via the Gwen Towers, cell phone towers, and via HARP. And this is very sophisticated and is run from behind, is controlled through a massive mind control network that is operative not only in the U.S. and Canada, but worldwide. And so that, I would say that what I experienced when I went public and said that the Judy model, the Judy Wood model was really it, and was that I experienced the next day members of 9/11 truth organizations calling me up from all over, New York, Vancouver, wherever, this kind of electronic gang stalking, you know, these emails about me and all this kind of stuff, but that it's like these people are taken over by an electronic impulse and taken over by this mass consciousness. I had one person call me from New York, from the 9/11 truth movement in New York, and it's as though I was talking to a puppet. And I know that person, their consciousness was displaced. And I believe that those are documented Co-IntelPro techniques. So it's kind of the 21st century version of what the 1920s communist infiltrator was. It's really an electronic mind control matrix.
Okay, you're way out beyond what I have familiarity with here. But if you what I gather you're saying is that there are kind of electronic technologies which will send out frequencies which can affect people's mental processes and therefore behavior, and that this can be done from someplace remote, far away?
Yes, yes. If you read Dr. Nick Begich, who wrote the classic book Angels Do Not Play This Harp, he lives in Alaska. His father was Congressman Begich, who was murdered under suspicious circumstances. Dr. Nick Begich has just come out with a fantastic book that documents all of this technology, and it is part of a hidden of social control, and it's electronic harassment and gang stalking. And this applied to get in a kind of a COINTELPRO format to co-opt opposition movements.
Well, thank you. I'm certainly going to try to run that book down. Is that, you say B-E-G-E-T?
No, B-E-G-I-C-H.
Oh, excuse me. It's B-E-G-I-C-H.
I see.
And if you just Google his name, Dr. Nick Begich, and I think his website is earthpulse.com, and he's written, he's an extraordinary researcher and an author. And this is his most recent book, and he's gotten major support from the Lay Foundation. Dorothy Lay, she's the heiress to the Lay potato chips. She became a victim of this mind control, and so she's now become greatly concerned about it. And has lent the support of the Lay Foundation, so they hold scientific conferences and are documented this and bringing it to the surface. For example, this is one of the mechanisms by which it is posited, and we briefed one of the staff members of Representative Geoff Conyers on the Judiciary Committee on this. That this is one of the mechanisms by which the Congress is held hostage. If you go into the House of Representatives, they have extensive mind control devices that have been installed there throughout the Congress and throughout the congressional office buildings. And these will affect individuals' behavior. It goes to the limbic system of the brain, which controls emotions, so you can make people fearful, apathetic, etc. This came to public light in the European Union, and the European Union sued the National Security Agency and sued NSA because the U.S. government infiltrated the European Parliament in the late 1980s with mind control electronic harassment weapons in order to try and influence the European Parliament's decision on banning U.S. Cruise missiles from Western Europe. These mind control was actually discovered, and there are reports of the European Parliament which document the technology and the attacks upon EU parliamentary members by the U.S. Military intelligence.
Well, this is very interesting. It's certainly an extremely, to me right now anyway, kind of a far-out explanation, but I guess one that would help account for the fact that our Congress has behaved so pitifully since 2001, giving up habeas corpus, allowing terrorism, et cetera, just completely rolling over, caving in on so many important issues. Would you say that this would help account for that?
Yes, it is remarkable once one gets into the area and becomes familiar with the technology, which can be done relatively easily through sources like Dr. Nick Begich's book. There are also five or six major organizations on the internet and available research that then one can see how these elements, which were brought over via Operation Paperclip from the Third Reich after World War II, and have been used as for the implementation of a fascistic form in the U.S. post World War II, it becomes very, very clear. So we believe that this is a major way by which what we call the New World Order or attempted imposition of martial law is being implemented through a very large use of electronic harassment, mind control harassment, and gang stalking techniques.
Lauren had mentioned something about that taking place around Berkeley or Stanford. Is that correct? Are you familiar with?
Yes. Yes, sorry. Yes. We have worked in this area as an anti-mind control activist since 1977. What occurred to me in 1977 was that I was a futurist at Stanford Research Institute, and I was the director of a project in the Jimmy Carter White House, and I was attacked with electronic mind control weapons while meeting with an assistant secretary of defense at the inner ring of the Pentagon in October 1977. And all of this is documented in an affidavit which I filed in a national press conference. It took place on May 9, 2001. But until that attack occurred to me in October of 1977, I had no idea that these sort of what they call, they call them, quote, non-lethal weapons, which is a misnomer, but that these sort of advanced electronic weapons, which cause severe dislocation of the psychic and limbic and neurological functioning of the biosystem of one's bioorganism, exist. And that's when I first experienced that, and when I became involved as an anti-mind control activist, and when I learned how these techniques have been used in order to accelerate the demise of democracy and compromise the instruments of government and the instruments of our democracy and judiciary. That the lesson further came home to me when, as an attorney in the 1987 to 1990 period, I prosecuted a series of 26 courts in a complex litigation series of 26 cases in the federal courts of Canada and the U.S. and the provincial courts of Canada, and discovered that these devices are implanted in the U.S. federal courts, in the Canadian courts, and are used to severely limit the actions of lawyers and jurists in key cases.
Wow. Can I just stop?
And all of that is documented in my book, The Levesque Cases.
Oh, okay. I need to do a station stop here. So it's KHENLP 106.9 Salida. This is Truth Quest with Melody and Eric Carlstrom, and our guest tonight is Alfred Weber. Okay.
Alfred, the book that you mentioned is called The Levesque Cases. Could
yes.
you spell that?
It's L-E-V-E-S-Q-U-E, The Levesque Cases. And you can get that on Amazon. It's out of print now. But I was kind of that book was written in 1990, and I was recently contacted by a number of anti-mind control activists throughout the U.S., and that book is being circulated among them now as one of the early examples of an attorney who fought back and a plaintiff who fought back against these techniques.
Well, this is interesting. I must confess I know absolutely nothing about this. And I guess the ignorant question that comes to the top of my mind is that are all of us susceptible to this? Are some more susceptible than others? How does one guard against this kind of mind control, et cetera?
Wow. Yeah, those are really key issues. I guess the main issue from a personal standpoint is to hope that one never becomes an individual target, what they call a TI, a targeted individual, because the nature of the technology is such to target one individually with these very painful electronic weapons, and since you can't see them, and since they don't have physiological effects like a poison would or like a a gunshot would, you can't prove that's happening to you. And since these the existence of these weapons and the system has been kept out of the mainstream media, the targeted individual really becomes a victim. For the more general population, we as a general population are now being subjected more and more to electronic mind control as a means of covert governance. And there are studies, once one get into this in Australia, for example, of how mind control has been used vis-a-vis elections, where they will instill fear or apathy in the general population prior to election day so they won't feel like go out and voting. And now, ever since the widespread implementation of the HARP system, which is a multi-layered weapon, one of whose function is a global mind control system, well, they can footprint entire populations either at a city level or a continent-wide level, and throw the population into fear or into apathy or into anger, and correlate that, say, with a run-up to an illegal war like the invasion of Iraq or now the attempted invasion of Iran. So the use of electronic mind control weapons becomes a covert instrument of governance.
So like with 9/11, they were using many multiple layers of psyops, or even with the date of 9/11, it in its own right became like a triggering code. Am I correct?
That's precisely so. Yes, yes, that's exactly so, Melody. And we have uncovered witnesses that are willing to come forth at the 9/11 War Crimes Tribunal. That eyewitnesses to Donald Rumsfeld's planning 9/11 as early as 1971.
I've heard that also, like maybe the towers were even built with that in mind.
Yes, yes, because they were built by the Rockefeller brothers, David and Nelson, and one tower was called David, and one tower was called Nelson, and the Rockefeller family. And this verges into that other topic that we were about to get into, the Rockefeller family are the kingpins of the North American International War Crimes Racketeering Organization, by our evidence, and appear to be and were set up, in fact, going back to John D. Rockefeller, as the agents of the House of Rothschild, which operates out of the city of London, which is a 677-acre quasi-independent jurisdiction at the heart of London, that's ruled over by a committee of 12 banks, led by the Bank of England, which is mediated by the House of Rothschild, whose net worth has been reliably statistically estimated at $100 trillion. And the Queen of England has to ask permission to come into the city of London.
So you're saying that they have more power than the Queen?
Yes. The City of London, in fact, rules the world and is the arbiter of the permanent war economy. And through an elaborate international war crimes racketeering organization, runs the permanent war economy for purposes of its own profit and also for purposes of world depopulation. This we have discovered by the evidence.
Okay, and that was something that was even discussed quite a bit, even at the turn of the, or the end of the 1800s. Am I correct? In some of the writings, anywhere from...
Malthus and...
Yeah, Malthus
yes.
And...
Well, yes. If you go back to Malthus, he was an obscure English economist who became the mouthpiece of the City of London at that time to implement their depopulation views. This is a long-term plan by these interests. We can call it the Anglo-American Neo-Zionist bloc to implement a world society of kind of slave wage earners under a banking elite and a severely reduced world population.
All right, H.G. Wells I had them all on the top of my tongue now. Now my mind's gone blank. But there was a number of them at the turn of the century that were speaking about this. And in fact, I've been trying to find a quote that I'd read from John Rockefeller about even utilizing the environmental movement to help facilitate this part of this process. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. All of these movements have been used in that fashion. If we go back to the Rockefeller family, just to give people a concept of the degree of moral turpitude of this elite, John D. Rockefeller made $1 trillion on World War I. Now, World War I was, quote, the war to end all wars. It introduced a catastrophic level of human suffering. And from the point of view of the City of London and the International War Crimes Racketeering Organization, to whom war is an industrial activity, that represented an extraordinary profit-making opportunity. So John D. Rockefeller made, in dollars of those times, $1 trillion on World War I.
Well, another thing that I've noticed with him is that it seemed like he utilized his money to influence anywhere from medicine to education to belief systems, lifestyles, you name it. He pretty much tried to cover every gamut so that there was a control mechanism there. Am I correct?
Yes, yes. There's a very deep story going on with the Rockefellers. They funded the world's eugenic movement, including funding and founding the eugenic clinic in Germany, where a number of the German war criminals were subsequently trained. In the population elimination camps, and it was the Rockefellers acting on behalf of eugenics think tanks that were funded in the UK that really gave rise to this. At a certain point of time, the name of eugenics was changed to population control, to make it more publicly palatable and from a PR point of view. But the entire purposes of World War One and World War Two and all subsequent wars have been depopulation and the undermining of the values of Western democracy.
I just got through watching the Endgame that Alex Jones had released recently, but it looks like he's done another 2 hours to add to it just within the last day or two. But it really gets into how deep this goes and how wide.
Right, and what's very hopeful now is that all of this is being exposed, and that the last remaining Rockefeller, in my judgment, David Rockefeller, will be acknowledged as a war criminal before he dies.
What do you think, Alfred, stands between us now and martial law that has been so carefully prepared for by our elite?
Well, again, that's a very good question. There has been a tremendous effort, as we all know, since the Kennebunkport warning to expose as much as possible any movement by the Bush-Cheney administration to create a false flag operation in the U.S. through either a nuclear or a biowarfare event. And there's been constant vigilance. As we know, the members of the armed forces came forward and leaked that. There's reports, the issue of the six cruise missiles, the reports that a number of them were killed as a result of this. So it's been constant vigilance. However, there is one event which lies ahead which could conceivably trigger military government, and that is the collapse of the U.S. dollar. And I just finished reading yesterday a report by a gentleman, Ken Dabkowski, which analyzes that there is a severe probability, because of the credit overhang, that by March of 2008, there may be a precipitous drop in the U.S. dollar, and from which it will never recover, because the fundamental weakness of the Federal Reserve System, which, as we know, was engineered by the City of London and the House of Rothschild through David Warburg, who engineered the bank panic of 1907 as a false flag operation, in kind of a cause-effect way, then went to set up the Federal Reserve Bank in 1913 with secret legislation that was rushed through to have as a central bank, which is in fact a private bank owned by the large private banks, which they functioned since 1913 forward, in which what they've done is they privatized the U.S. dollar, and they make that privatized currency the reserve currency for the world, so that these private banks, which are fronts for the House of Rothschild, is controlled by one family of neo-Zionist persuasion, actually owns the currency of the world as a private property.
So then they're like the bankers for you're saying they're bankers of the world, anywhere from for the Vatican to the, you know, all the other countries and
well,
the Queen.
They own the currency. They own the monopoly set at which we all play economy. So we are in debt the moment that we're born, because money should be a public utility. money should be a public property, not private property. But the point that I'm getting at here is that the fundamental weakness of the Federal Reserve Bank as a central bank, because it's not a true central bank, it's not a public agency, it's owned by private banks, is that when you have the failure of one or two of the major partners in that bank as private banks, then the Federal Reserve Bank is crippled and can no longer function as a central bank. And that looks like what is about to happen in the United States starting in March of 2008, when it is projected that the credit crunch will become critical and a number of the major banks will fail because of the subprime mortgage fraud. There's been over $1 trillion pumped into the Federal Reserve System now to keep those banks afloat, but they do not think with the credit crunch coming over the Christmas, they don't think that it will be able to survive past March, or at least be in a severe critical state by then. That could yield to a quote catastrophic emergency, which could be the conditions under which some form of military government is established, particularly if you have hyperinflation of the U.S. dollar. I mean, you know, I've seen pictures of even in Bosnia, there's just like pictures of a, you know, 20 billion, you know, denomination note. I mean, I've seen pictures of a 5 billion mark note in Germany in the 1920s. So if you have manufactured hyperinflation in the U.S., where the value of the dollar drops dramatically, where they have a plan for the introduction of the Amero as a substitute currency, and you have a collapse in the U.S. economy if China really plays the dollar nuclear bomb. All they have to do is sell their dollars, which many are doing, and you will have the catastrophic event in the U.S., which will bring on some form of military rule. This is a hypothetical, this is a speculative scenario. So what I'm saying is that once one gets into the analysis, it may be that the next level of threat to our civil liberties is a projected collapse of the U.S. dollar sometimes in 2008. So that's why we've always said that one of the most critical questions is whether the 2008 election will be held, and it may be held with great difficulty. So we're in for a really, the U.S. dollar is in for a rough ride in 2008.
Last week, Alfred, we had a couple guests who talked about the North American Union and plans and the NAFTA superhighway, things like that. And one was named Jerome Corsi, and the other was named
Bill Molina.
Bill Molina. And,
hey,
and
you've got excellent guests there.
Yeah, we've done pretty well
for this
little town.
You guys are really doing first-rate community radio. This is tremendous.
Well, thank you. And I seem to recall that they were talking about a scenario by which we would be thrown into the North American Union. It would be an economic disaster of some kind. And then the Amero would be introduced perhaps as the solution to this problem, which may or may not have been created by the bankers themselves.
Yes, and that's a mechanism for the massive expropriation of wealth, because since the government can determine the exchange rate between the Amero and whatever the devalued dollar's worth, it means that the conditions are set up for a massive expropriation of wealth by the U.S. Treasury and by the Federal Reserve, which is a private bank. which means that the entire middle class and even sectors of the upper class of the U.S. could become paupers and therefore subject to having their civil liberties taken away.
I've heard from one U.N. or indirect U.N. member that had thought that they needed to bring our middle class down to third class to equalize it with the Mexican population for when they try to bring us into the North American Union. Are you aware of what I'm talking about?
Yes, yes. That is the philosophy of the City of London, and they're now 2 to 3 centuries old, some say longer, plan, which is to destroy all of the democracies and to bring all countries to second-tier status, those in first-tier status down to second, those in third-tier status up to second. So you have a single worldwide economic wage slave class with no constitutional guarantees under a bloodline elite.
How close do you think they are to doing this?
I don't think that they're going to be successful because we're becoming more and more awake. And this is where it the awakeness, the degree to which the population awakens to their being in a condition of threat, coupled with the disintegration of the attempted plan for world domination, that attempted plan, I believe, is going to fail. And there are many signs of that. And you can go to isolated instances like the victory that Dennis Kucinich and the pro-impeachment forces achieved in the House Judiciary Committee recently.
I wasn't too sure that it didn't sound like to some that they thought that was a victory because of the way it came about. Did I misinterpret something there?
Well, the way that it came about exposed the fact that the Congress is controlled. The result was that the aware people are now aware how controlled the Congress is, and as a matter of parliamentary procedure, have a bill in the Judiciary Committee that now they can focus on the members of the Judiciary Committee and keep up the pressure. So long as there hasn't been this transparency, they have been able to keep that going. But now this transparency is becoming forward. For example, it was recently established that Nancy Pelosi is from a prominent Argentinian Zionist family. She is not Italian, as her PR handlers have been trying to say, and she's married to a San Francisco real estate tycoon with neo-Zionist leanings. So it's clear, given the power of AIPAC, the Israel lobby, probably why she was made first woman Speaker of the House. It's because of her accession to the principles of the Israel neo-Zionist lobby, which were, number one, unfettered ability to carry out a preemptive attack against Iran, and number two, impeachment was off the table because that would threaten the AIPAC and a permanent war economy puppets in power, Richard B. Cheney and George W. Bush, and would threaten the accession of power for the next generation of AIPAC puppets in Hillary and Bill Clinton and Governor Bill Richardson.
I wanted to change it just a little bit here because I noticed that you've been involved in somewhat of the depleted uranium, getting that information out and what's going on with that in use as a weapon in Iraq?
Yes. What I did after last spring, in February of 2007, I had the privilege of being named as a judge on the International Kuala Lumpur International War Crimes Tribunal. And we heard one day of testimony in Kuala Lumpur from a number of classes of witnesses. One of the classes of witnesses was from U.S. torture, U.S. and U.K. torture in Iraq, in Palestine. We heard from witnesses such as the famous Man in the Hood. Remember that photograph of the Man in the Hood
in
Abu Ghraib prison?
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah, well, he was one of the witnesses there.
Oh.
And he was a quite innocent man who was walking on his way home and was picked up and was tortured. The other category of witnesses that we heard was with regard to the use of depleted uranium in U.S. and U.K. munitions going back to 1991. And you've had expert guests on your program. So I don't need to tell you that the effects of the ionizing radiation of depleted uranium released in the Afghan war, which was an illegal war triggered by the false flag operation of 9/11, in which they went in and carpet bombed Afghanistan with depleted uranium, the equivalent of a low-level nuclear war, which is found to be genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes by the Tokyo Tribunal for War Crimes in Afghanistan. Well, that same scenario has been repeated in Iraq, and now the ionizing radiation that has been carpet bombed in Iraq and in Afghanistan takes about 14 days to reach North America. And North America is now experiencing record levels, along with most of the world, of diabetes, for example, and other health effects of ionizing radiation, including autism, mental illness. The United States of America has one of the highest, if not the highest, index of mental illness in the world, 26% of the U.S. population, according to World Health Organization statistics, have a mental health diagnosis. And that, it is posited, is due to the effects of, number one, atmospheric testing and underground testing at the Nevada test site from 1945 forward. If you go into the typical nuclear bomb or atom bomb, the plutonium core is very small, and the rest of the bomb is actually filled with depleted uranium tamping, and that's what makes it radioactive. So the entire U.S. population is being subjected to ionizing radiation from these atmospheric tests, which is still in the atmosphere and in the soil. Number two, nuclear power plants, which are like a low-level nuclear war against the urban population or rural population where the nuclear power plants are located. And number three, the depleted uranium that is wafting over through the trade winds and the westerlies from the depleted uranium bombing in Iraq and Afghanistan. If we look here in Canada, the diabetes rate in Canada has now exceeded the World Health Organization's estimate of the maximum for through 2050. So there's more diabetes here in Canada now than was expected for 2050.
Well,
this is all due to depleted uranium bombing.
I've even heard that they want to start selling lots or whatever, building homes there at Rocky Flats.
Yeah. So that the whole brunt of this and the way it relates to 9/11 is that 9/11 was a false flag operation that permitted the triggering of a worldwide low-level nuclear war for purposes of depopulation and genetic damaging of the human race.
And then you can tie that in with the biowarfare and the HAARP or other mind control weaponry, or like you were describing, more sounded more like microwave weapons, if I'm correct, when you were talking.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. If you look at this depopulation policy, it's carried out through specific methodologies and technologies that are highly documented through the ionizing radiation that we've talked about, through the weaponization of food, making food a weapon through the GMO crops, through a lot of the toxic substances that are in the environment and products that we use, through bioweapons that are contained in vaccines and in potential flus like the avian flu, which has been exposed as a potential bioweapon that would eliminate up to 2 billion people, which is one third of the human race. So all of this plan, which is diabolical in nature, has been put into effect and implemented through operatives and contractors of the City of London, two of which occupy the White House and the Vice Presidency. They do not genuinely serve the U.S., but they are operatives of the City of London.
Alfred, we had another excellent guest a couple weeks ago named Alan Watt, a fellow Canadian, I believe, of yours. And he guesstimates there are only about 3,000 of the world's truly ruling elite. And if so, or even if it is somewhat larger than that, the question always comes to my mind how these individuals expect to escape the kind of ravages, the environmental ravages that are going to cause depopulation of the rest of us.
That's a very excellent question. And it's a question that those of us, as you can imagine, who are involved in the field, struggle with that question every day. I've come up with a couple of alternative approaches to it. One is that what has been created here really is a doomsday machine, that the permanent war economy has been so technologized and now has been so computerized that a matrix of AI, artificial intelligence, has been created, whether anticipated or unanticipated, and that AI is a doomsday machine that is bent on destruction, on ecocide, genocide, and omnicide, on killing off of the entire planet. And that's what the AI is programmed for. And that may or may not have been a programmed sequence. Once one gets into the field of, quote, diabolical intent, don't forget that it was the purposes of the diabolical will or intent to destroy the planet. Well, that seems to be the diabolical intent of this AI. So the evolution of my own thinking has been that this is really beyond the individual Rothschild, whether Benjamin Rothschild, who allegedly can pick up a phone and call in the Hell's Angels and RCMP and destroy any individual in Canada on demand at any time, and there have been documented cases of that, calling in from his chateau in Switzerland. We call the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police here, the Rothschild-controlled murdering police, because they are just that. And there are documented cases of that on file now. Most recently, an individual from Poland who was mind-controlled for 4 hours in the controlled passenger and customs area and then tasered to death by the RCMP. Fortunately, that's hitting all of the headlines now. So the model that I'm holding now is that what the permanent war economy has created, whether intentionally or not, it may be intentionally in a kind of a Dr. Strangelove way, and I think that that movie really gets to the essence of this, is that we have unleashed an artificial intelligence matrix, which is a doomsday machine, which is actually running all of this. It's running World War III. It's running all of the weapon systems. It's running all of the financial systems, which are now collapsing, and it is programmed for the ultimate demise of the human race, so that what we have to do in order to survive is to create alternative institutions, and that's where I spend most of my time these days. I've sort of gotten away from full-time research on the negative, which is the breakdown, and begun to spend a lot of my working day on creating the new institutions of the future that are going to be able to serve as a safety net and collect up mankind when the world currency system collapses, finding cures for that neutralize the effect of ionizing radiation. At the same time, we continue to fight very, very, very assiduously. For example, here in Canada, we now have received the expert evaluations of Dr. Douglas Rocky, who was head of the U.S. Army's environmental program on DU, Dr. Chris Busby of the European Parliament's Radiation Unit, and Loren Murray, independent scientist, is preparing her own report, which is going into the new Democratic Party, various members of Parliament, to try and stop DU. Well, once you get to that, you get to the possible compromising of parliamentarians within the parliament, just as you have it in the House of Representatives and Senate in the U.S. So one has to divide one's time as much between monitoring the breakdown as building for the breakthrough.
So that's where you're saying then it isn't necessarily it's more of a compromising of these organizations than it is, or is that a toss-up between compromise and infiltration of these groups?
Put it this way.
Okay.
If I took the model of the International War Crimes Racketeering Organization, which I would say, in North America, it's the Rockefeller Organizations and Networks, and the Skull and Bones or Order of Death networks, which are interlocking. That's sort of how the North American branch. And in the UK, it's Masonic Satanic networks within the media, police, banking, finance, and the City of London. And in Europe, it's the Bilderberger groups with the what they call the black nobility of Europe, who go back centuries in this kind of satanic elitist control mechanism that is fueling this entire plan. If I put them out and I say, gee, you know, if we just eliminated all of these people, all of this would stop, you know, if we just had them legally accountable. I think that the problem now transcends individuals. And we are actually at maybe, I use the word maybe because it's still a hypothesis, we may be subject to the control of an artificial intelligence which has grown out of the technologization of the permanent war economy, which runs the monetary system, it runs the depleted uranium system, it runs everything. It runs human beings. Those human beings that are plugged into the matrix now have lost their humanity and become servants of this AI. That was a message that a science fiction writer and great scientist, Sir Arthur C. Clarke, who coincidentally is the chairman of our board at the Institute for Cooperation in Space, had in his novel, Childhood's End. And I think that that's the nature of the challenge that we face now on this planet.
So didn't he also do 2001 Space Odyssey?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
And that's where the promise comes in, and we haven't touched on a whole other field that I'm active in. I kind of like to keep the two fields separate, but that other field is exopolitics, which my book, Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe, helped found. And that provides a very hopeful future for humanity. And as you stated, perhaps it's on some other occasion we can speak about that.
Let me ask you this, Alfred. you talked about artificial intelligence. You talk about the kind of satanic influences that we see in many of these institutions. And you talk about how people can become servants of this artificial intelligence. And this, I live in a community called Crestone in Colorado where there are a lot of spiritual groups. And I wonder if you think that something as simple as the power of prayer or meditation is an effective antidote to some extent to the kind of group mind control that we might be seeing here.
You know, that again, that's such a great question. I myself, the first thing that I do every day before I even get out of bed is I spend 1 hour in silent meditation and prayer. And I think that it's that sort, I call it civil defense, individual civil defense. and it's that strengthening one's own inner core and inner reserves, so that whenever we have to interact with the matrix, be it at a job, be it interacting with law enforcement, be it interacting with the war, be it interacting with any portion of the matrix that seeks to overtake one's free will and stunt one's spiritual and growth potential, I think that individual meditation and prayer and individual discernment is the foundation of how we're all going to get through this.
I appreciate your answer, and I see that I agree totally. I do the same myself, and I think that this is kind of an armor, kind of a exercise that one can do to make one's spirit stronger and stand up longer, perhaps, against these really unseen, almost unseen forces.
Yes, and now it seems Alex Jones' title is very apt. End game. It seems like we're coming to the end game phase, and my sincere perception is that endgame applies to the permanent war economy, and that is that we are being given the tools to transform the permanent war economy with all of its components, like the false flag operation, the low-level nuclear wars, the illegal wars, the just wearing down and attempt to take away our civil liberties and to, in effect, destroy the human race and all and all living things, that all of that is a giant robot, artificial intelligence robot that is going to fall. There's that famous biblical line that I just love that says, what is it, Babylon, Babylon, within a single hour thou art fallen or something. You know, and that's exactly how systems that are corrupted and dysfunctional, they'll click along, and then there's a point at which there's a critical mass reached, and those systems just fall to the ground. And that's probably what's going to happen to the permanent war economy.
So you're not, I guess what I'm trying to follow here is that there isn't, it's going to be an awakening of the humans to rise above this, or we're just going to fall prey to this.
No, I didn't mean to miscommunicate. My perception is that in the midst of the breakdown of this system, which has been a plan, a covert plan for corrupted takeover of and dominance of the planet, right in the middle of it, the new dimension, what the Hopis call the fifth world, is in fact being born. And if you look at complex systems, they can reorganize themselves at a higher level of functioning through what's called a breakdown breakthrough model. And this happens in many different areas. It can happen in personal relationships, in families, in business relationships, in organizations, in any kind of system. You can have a breakdown of the old way of doing things and the old understandings. And out of that breakdown comes a breakthrough to a new, better level of understanding. And that's the process that I believe that we're undergoing now. So in a certain way, one can look at the breakdown of the artificial intelligence of the old system, the old robot that we've been serving for the last X number of hundred years, is actually a hopeful sign. Gee, it's just about over, isn't it?
Well, I guess I would have never looked at it that way, but I understand where you're going with that. It's kind of like you know, the training when you're going into the military or numerous other aspects of reprogramming humans.
Yeah, this is about reframing, and what the permanent war economy tries to do is to fit us all in certain boxes so that we feel trapped. Well, if we just reframe it and we see that it's the artificial intelligence of the permanent war economy that has gotten itself into a box where it is falling, and we are now creating the institutions of the future, then things are much more optimistic.
Well, I've heard him speak of the some computers that actually have us programmed into them. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Well, yeah, the concept that computers can think, and that the whole the internet, which is kind of some form of exemplification of our collective mind, and you know, newer generations of artificial intelligence are all outgrowths of this. What we need to do is to change the software. The software now is war is good and war is all we do, and so we just change that to where, oh, what we do is sustainable, cooperative, peaceful, space-age society.
So if everything runs off a frequency, and even if we had computers that were working within the range of our parameters, could there not be like a interchange or exchange of those, to where if you did like you're, you know, theoretically you could change the software in a computer and raise not only the computer's vibration but man. Are you following what I'm saying?
Yes. And to go back to the example of Sir Arthur C. Clarke's 2001, what happened there is that the AI, HAL, the computer, began to think like a human, but he began to think like a human of the permanent war economy, i.e. toward destruction. Well, we now have a whole series of values and ways of constructing society which are not programmed toward destruction, but they're programmed toward constant evolution and expansion. And it's that dimension that is now breaking through, because we have broken through the rules of the permanent war economy and the limits of it, and we are now successfully organizing worldwide.
Okay. I was going to ask you, Alfred, what is your take on the role of the United Nations in, perpetuating the problem or the solution?
Wow, another good question. Thank you so much. The UN, by its nature, is part of the problem under one formulation because, of course, it was founded by order of death, Skull and Bones, and Rockefeller sources. It essentially is owned by the City of London, by the Rothschilds. And so that it functions now as an instrument of the cover-up, as an instrument of the permanent war economy. Specific examples. When one goes in and examines it closely, the UN perpetuates genocides ranging from Rwanda to Darfur to the latest genocide that is emerging now in Somalia. It perpetuates the depleted uranium low-level ecocidal war that took place in Yugoslavia, in the former Yugoslavia in the 90s, in Iraq starting in 1991, in all of Central Asia. So it is, by that definition, an instrument of the cover-up. At the same time, since we're in a situation of breakdown of the old order, one can begin to approach caucuses of nations or individual, you know, groups of nations, member nations. There are 193 member nations of the UN, and if you approach them at an individual member nation level, their desires are quite the opposite. If we look at the last vote at the UN General Assembly, which occurred in December 2006 on the issue of the weaponization of space, the vote was 174 in favor of banning the weaponization of space versus one vote that was for the weaponization of space. That vote, of course, was the U.S. So it depends on how one approaches that instrument, whether it's part of the war crimes and been compromised because of its the fact that it was founded by the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, who provided all the land and the ideology and the structure. It's like any other transitional institution. Will there or will there not be a Vatican in the future world? Will there or will there not be this, the United Nations in its present form? Well, these institutions have to evolve.
Well, boy, I can see we're going to have you back another time. We could, because I know there's several other avenues that we haven't even touched upon. But I really appreciate you coming on, Alfred, and informing our listening audience this evening. And And again, I hope, like I said, I hope we can have you back again.
Well, thanks so much, Alfred.
Oh, well, thank you.
For the excellent discussion. We learned a lot, and I think it was very informative for people.
You know, and just from my end, I'll say it very briefly, I really appreciate the space that you have provided here for the interaction and for the receptivity to all of these ideas and material. And I think that you are among the more advanced radio talk show hosts that I have encountered. You're really living researchers and in search of the truth. So I have to commend you.
Well, thank you.
And we certainly congratulate you and thank you for all the work that you're doing at this critical time. It's wonderful to be able to talk to you about it.
And so this is Truth Quest, and this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And coming up next is Joe Frank. Thanks again, Alfred.
Thank you. Good night.